Hello and welcome back to Breach Burnt. Today, we've got a couple people with us. Scott and Zach will be joining us later, but we're going to be talking today about how to learn new keywords, things to look out for, strategies to tackling crews you're not familiar with. So yeah, that's the topic of the day. Anything off the top of your head, Scott, or I can get into my angler experiences?
Sure. I've been starting on kind of two new crews here. I've been trying out some Euripides, Old One Eye, and as just about everybody else in the Malifaux verse, been trying out some of the new masters from the new book. I've been playing Castor, so both versions of him to give him a try. So my experience, because I've been playing Malifaux for a couple of years, is that for myself, and this is kind of like if someone asked me my opinion on it, what I recommend is, like, once you've picked your crew, you know, you're past that, oh, what do I want to play, you know, whether you're going for the rule of cool or a certain play style, or, you know, just trying stuff out because, you know, before you buy models, you're borrowing your friend's stuff and all, is that once you get past that stage, I like to do is make a list and just run it 4, 5, 6 games in a row without making too many changes to it, even though it may not be the best for the pool, or the, I should say the best crew for that pool. I will still run it because if you are someone who plays in the tournament, you always want to take the best crew for that pool. But sometimes you can also learn what that crew can do if you take it in what you may think is a suboptimal pool. Maybe it does better in that than you would think. You know, you can learn the deficiencies of the crew by, okay, I need to, let's say, do breakthrough. And, you know, maybe it can do that, maybe it can't. And then if once you've tried that scheme, you find out, yes, this crew does struggle to go for that, for that scheme that is deep in your opponent's crew. So taking something like that, you can learn the weaknesses of the crew, so when you do get to a level where you are not just practicing that crew to learn it, you can find pools and or schemes that you know not to take with that because you have already taken it in the past and have learned the weakness of that crew.
Definitely. Cool. Well, yeah, that's a good start to this. So I'll just talk a little bit about the anglers. So I played over the winter break. I had some time off, and I played 10 games of the anglers in a row. So first time I've really strayed heavily from Neverborn since I started playing. Definitely haven't played Bayou before, and I also had not... Anglers didn't exist before I started trying them out, so I didn't really know what to expect going in. So kind of my general strategy was I took one of everything pretty much. So took both henchmen, both enforcers, maybe a handful of minions, and I tried to do that every game. I played the first title for the first 5 games and the other title for the second 5 games, and I did indeed learn quite a bit very quickly. And yeah, I think learning, there is a certain amount of pain you just have to expect, where the game's just not going to go well. You'll definitely lose unless your opponent is also learning something. You'll see a lot of inefficiencies, mess up a lot of, you know, auras or triggers, maybe cheating the wrong cards for things, but over time you definitely see how each model excels and what they are not good at. So, like, an example would be Cervantes. I thought would be kind of a melee god because he's 2-inch melee, stat 7, with great triggers. He has armor 2. He's slow, but you can get him up there really quick. So I did so every game, and he died every game, turn 1 or 2. So then I kind of had to reevaluate, well, what really is his role? I think his role is more of a tar pit support assassin than a frontline beater. And that's something that you just kind of learn the more you play with the crew, I think. Especially with the anglers, there was a lot of power there that I didn't see from the cards. Like how much utility Bog brings, moving stuff around. How often you can drop tide markers so that you're helping out multiple people at a time. Those sorts of things I definitely started to unlock the more I played. Did I ever play anglers into you, Scott?
Yeah, we did. We played one game. I think that was actually one of your early games. Honestly, I don't remember what I played against you, but I know I did play a game against you because you're the only one I played that had faced anglers. I think this was before the app came out, so you're using the book, so which you know obviously makes it a little bit more difficult, makes it easier to forget things. But following up on your point with Cervantes, I mean, my first game I played with Castor Fervent, I kind of did that thing. And I played him with Neverborn. And this is like my first game. I was like, okay, let's see what this guy can do. I'm going to just throw him up the board with a sword. And we're going to see how much face I can wreck and or my face getting wrecked. I wanted to see what he could do to survive if he just dives into the opponent's crew. I kind of did this too and this was a while ago when I was... when I was learning my Lucius II crew. If anyone's ever played me against my Lucius II, I have kind of a different Lucius II list than you kind of generally see, and I take the emissary in it. And I was playing against the Explorer's Master with the big gun. His name escapes me. And I'm like, okay, I want to see how much this guy can survive. How can I throw my mysterious emissary up front with a gun line and see what can he do? How much can he survive with his armor, with the shield that the lawyers can give him, and see what happens with that. And he actually lasted a lot longer than I expected him to, because he basically had all his guns went into him. He sent the dogs in, Model 9, and he lasted quite a bit, and he did quite a bit of damage before he went down. But yeah, that's kind of one of those things when you're doing that learning thing. Like if you're taking a BD master, well, let's throw him in the opponent's crew and see what he can do. So that way, in a game that may matter to you more, like more in a competitive atmosphere as opposed to, you know, at the local store, then you have an idea of, okay, well, that crew I'm facing is really BD. I can't just take my Alpha Strike Master and throw him in there turn one, expect him to make it through turn two. So those are the kind of things you have to do when you're practicing a new crew, is maybe not might be the most smart thing to do to win that game, but in the long run, it will help you win games down the road to know what exactly you can or cannot do with a master or a crew.
You're getting the feel of how long something will last on the table, especially against an incredibly strong offensive crew, is something that's really useful because it can help you just sort of, contextually speaking, learn how much you can give and how much you have to take in that situation to keep it alive so it can actually do its job. Though, admittedly, the Mysterious Emissary survives way too long every time.
Because he's a Neverborn model and it's perfectly balanced.
Yep, that's why they haven't done anything to him yet.
Exactly. But and also, too, when you're making that evaluation, you have to remember, too, that, okay, let's say he doesn't survive whatever, you know, with my examples with Castle Fervent or the Mysterious Emissary. He doesn't survive. Now, did my opponent flip sphere damage twice on double negs and one time hit the Red Joker and... he died? Well, then you have to take that into consideration. Or, wow, this guy survived three turns of these min 3 beaters on him. Well, did they flip Black Jokers on damage flips, and you're flipping the Red Joker on your defense flips? So you have to kind of take that into consideration in your evaluation. Was this a true example of what he can do, or was it, you know, on the opposite ends of, you know, that you had some funky Red Joker, Black Joker interaction there and stuff like that. So you got to make sure you're evaluating that in the context of how it happened, not just, you know, weird swingy flips.
Yeah, like my last game that I played, my opponent flipped moderate on effectively every damage flip they flipped that entire game. And it didn't matter how many negatives they were on. It happened, like, every time. And, yeah. I mean, sometimes you just have to roll with that and realize that maybe it's not exactly a accurate depiction of how durable your models are. Nobody's going to survive getting hit for, like, 4 damage over and over again.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, so, like, with my Euripides 2 crew I've been practicing with, my first 4 or 5 games, I took the same crew every single time. It was Tugarion, Damned, Baltugin, Thune, no upgrades. And I switched it up for my last game and took out the Baltugin and put in a Cyclops because I wanted to see what the Cyclops could do. So I think knowing that what your crew can do with this basic build when you're first playing your first couple games is important, because not only that you know what the crew can do, but then you're getting to learn the cards. After 2, 3, 4 games, as you go on, you should be forgetting those abilities less, or knowing what your TNs are, so when you look at your hand, okay, am I going to have the cards to hit my TNs? Like, for instance, I played a game last night. It was my first game with the Castor, the Castor 1, I guess they're calling him, the one that looks like he needs to, yes, the one that looks like he needs to eat a sandwich. And we played 4 turns, mainly because at the end of turn 4, my opponent only had 1 model left, so we kind of called it there. And I remembered Gwil saying when a leader activates that you get to discard a card and draw a card. I think I remembered that like 4 times out of 8 opportunities. So, you know, that's something that is another thing you have to think about when you're evaluating the crew. Like, well, if it didn't do what you thought it could do, were you remembering those abilities? Were you remembering those auras? Or, you know, if you are remembering them, you know, especially with the Castor crew I'm playing, is there's some significant auras that you want to be in the area of. Am I moving my crew too far out and now I'm not getting the benefit from these auras and stuff like that? So it can be a difficult thing to evaluate a crew the first couple of times you play them, especially if you're newer to the game. Is like, well, this crew seems underpowered. It's like, well, it can be, because, and as many people talk about, there are different power levels on crews. But is it because of the power level, or is it that you're either out of the auras, not staying in line of sights, or like one for people who play Zareta, when the opponent cheats, you know, being able to use her ability. Are you remembering that? I mean, I've played Zareta probably 20, 30 times, and I still forget that ability, because it's just not something that you really are thinking about when you're in the middle of the game when your opponent's cheating. So those are the kind of things you need to evaluate your crew on, areas for improvements. You know, and it always starts with remembering your abilities and, you know, if you have auras that you need in the area.
Well, I approach a new crew the same way every single time, basically. It's more of just how my brain works with it. So after I, you know, I pick out something I think looks cool or whatever, there's a few main things I kind of go over in my head. First off, I find my Teddy. And what I mean by that is, so like I started the game with Dreamer and Pandora. And so I played Teddy in basically every game back then. So whenever I go into a new keyword, I always try, if it exists, to locate the big min 3 beater, again, if it exists. Or you know, the rough approximation of like what is my big tanky-ish thing that hits hard. 'Cause I tend to cornerstone a lot of my crews usually with, you know, like that 10 stone beater, if it exists. After that, it's usually a matter of like I skim cards, see if there's TNs. Usually Weird's pretty good about making sure that TNs are pretty consistent across keywords, where it's like mostly like 6s or 5s or what have you for checks on your own abilities. And then I kind of follow that up really with just figuring out something I think is cool, like a combo or a trick or some Rube Goldberg, and I just try and put it into practice, you know? So, like, with Castor specifically, since, you know, he'd been brought up previously, and, you know, the purple and green share this one, my unpack with Castor, you know, figuring out the thing with the Urn Bearers and Atherac and such, where, like, you know, he activates and, you know, he, like, heals somebody, then they, like, they move into the aura, and then they move again, and you're pulsing out a bunch of, you know, shielded and getting a bunch of movement and everything before he even takes any actions. Like, that was something I really wanted to do first. And then following up on that, like, I really wanted to try and figure out setting up that big scrum, like being aggressive, forcing the scrum so my opponent's on the back foot, and then just rolling up there and then just using, not pustule, the down to the last drop onto a Black Blood model, just absolutely, like, double pinging the shit out of my opponent's crew and just melting them. And the few times I've managed to do it, it's come out great. And, you know, like, everybody, like when you get hit with that aggression to begin with, it's always a bit of a shocker. But then when you're swinging wide like that and hitting a bunch of models all at the same time, it was great. And, like, that was what I felt was the allure to my initial lookings at Castor. And I think once you figure that thing out that you want to do and you try and put it into practice, it really helps you learn the crew and what they're doing, because you're now searching those cards mechanically to find the things necessary to do the cool thing you wanted to do.
Yeah, and that's pretty similar to something I employed with the anglers as well. So look, fisher folk have a particular ability called use them as bait, which is after an enemy model comes into base contact with a friendly tide marker in line of sight, they have to discard a card or draw a card, or this model may draw a card. So that's a pretty simple thing, but for all five games I just tried to make that go off as many times as I could, because it seems like a very powerful ability and maybe the bread and butter of the crew, at least this version. So I don't think I got it for two games. I didn't get it to go off at all. And then the third game I got it to go off, but I was cheating. And then games 4 and 5, it did start to happen. So having those kinds of avenues can be very helpful, because they just force your brain into certain patterns of thought where you're thinking, how can I push an enemy model and have a tide marker where I want it to be. So you start trying to set up all those little scenarios so that you can start pulling it off a bunch. So
yeah, and that, like, to that point, it really just helps you explore, gain experience with, and develop the knowledge of the capabilities of all the models when you set up, like, a goal like that. That's something that you're trying to set up to really make it work. You know, something you feel like is a core tenet of the crew. And even if you don't succeed at it initially, I mean, like, that's just the learning process. But the more you do it, the more you get experience with it, the more knowledge that you have to actually go, well, I can do this, this, and this now. And suddenly now it becomes much more possible. And frankly, like, that's the sort of thing that makes people fall in love with it. You know,
mm-hmm.
Like, at least in my experience, you know, when you find that trick and you do that thing, I mean, that was Shtuk for me back in the day, you know, that was the Valley Bomb, you know, that was loading her up, launching her in, murking somebody, summoning in the undergrad and having them punch somebody when they come in and just absolutely wrecking their life. Even though they took that away, the hooks had already sunk into me after I'd initially done it. I mean, shit, you know, I mean, like, that's the sort of concept that made me fall in love with, like, the Dead Rider, you know, the first time I ever, you know, reaped somebody's model across the table. It was just one of the most satisfying things. So I think, especially when you're learning to play a crew, establishing those smaller personal goals within the crew, it helps you explore the mechanics of them, and generally speaking, will help you develop a certain bond with the crew, that otherwise, if you don't make those sort of goals, I feel you might lack.
Yeah. I'm kind of talking now maybe about specific models, how to learn. Like when I'm looking at like the Fisher Folk, for example, I typically look for, you know, defensive stuff or big auras or things that I can trigger a lot on the front of the card. So that really comes down to experience, knowing what to look for.
Sure.
But then as far as the actions, first couple of games, I'll just try to use one of the actions a bunch and just see how good it is in different situations. But eventually, I think you should try to use all of the actions a lot of times in good and bad situations. When you have the cards and when you don't have the cards. Because that's really when you start to learn kind of what feels like the next level stuff. So like the Clampets, I just did reel in a bunch and just moved my guys up the board, because it seems like what you want to do. Cervantes, you want him to get into things really quick.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized that using your master to unpack your crew probably isn't the best use of that master.
Right.
So I, you know, a couple games in, I did it like one time. And then now I don't really use it at all early in the game. I'm using it to pull things in and out of position once points are starting to matter. And those are the sorts of things you just learn from using an action over and over.
Yeah, so
good,
like,
and bad, you know?
Like a similar sort of concept. When I kind of figured out something with Return, specifically with Othorak and Castor Fervent. So Fervent Castor doesn't take damage from friendly models. So he reduces damage suffered from other friendly models in Black Blood to zero. Other than the interesting context, that means it's impossible to obey one of my models and have them attack my master and do anything. That's cool. One neat little thing about it, just for the sake of, like, if you really want to be aggressive with him and shove him forward, again, with Othorak's, of course, going to be going early on that first turn if you're using him and tossing out his ward stones, right? Well, at that point, you can do all that, you know, that initial startup where you're shifting people, giving them shield and whatnot. But you toss those ward stones up, and then you can attack Castor with his melee and get the mass trigger, which he will take no damage from, heal to, so he gets to move to, and then he gets to push up to four towards the ward stone markers. So at that point, you could shove him right up on those, so he's just behind them. So they still can't shoot him because he's got that wall of wardstone there, and he's now up the board quite a bit. This is a fun little trick. So, like, learning those things and discovering those things, and a lot of it kind of comes from practical stuff, because, like, I didn't necessarily notice the wording on Feast on the Faithful, where he doesn't take damage from those things initially. But it came with, after a couple of reps of playing them and seeing how these things interact, where it's like, oh yeah, I could just, like, charge him with a friend if I wanted to, have him heal, and, you know, he'll do this, and I can shift him out of, you know, like a melee range so he can charge in and blast and jump around and do all his typical shenanigans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in a lot of my games, when I'm learning in and when I'm not learning a new crew, I'll see weird plays that I don't know if they're good or bad plays, but they are a weird rule interaction that I just want to explore. And I'll say to my opponent, even, like, I don't know if this is a good idea, but we're going to try it out. And I do that a lot. And I don't win as many games as some people, but I learn weird combos pretty quick. yeah. And that's really, really important to me in the game. Makes it really fun for me, you know, more than winning sometimes, to my own detriment.
Well, building on that too, if you are going to be doing some kind of weird combo or just using some stuff like you were talking about with the anglers and their tide pools, trying to either make the opponent discard or you draw cards, having a conversation with that opponent after the game is like, hey,
yeah,
you know, did this did this really affect you? Did it not so much? Like for myself, when I've been playing my Euripides with the ruin tokens, I've asked several of my opponents, I'm like, hey, you know, me looking at your top two cards before you attack and making you discard the good ones and stuff like that, I'm like, do you feel that affects you a lot? Not so much, you know, I know touching other people's cards can sometimes get people grumpy. So usually the answer I get is yes, I hate it. And I can understand that because I think with the ruin tokens and the old ways is a very powerful combination. But outside of that, that specific example, getting that feedback from your opponent is like, you know, I was trying to do this. Did it affect you? Did you not care at all? And just get that feedback because, I mean, from your side of the board, it may seem one thing, but from your opponents, it's always nice to get that feedback. And I think, too, most games you play, you should try and give that feedback to your opponent. Hey, you know, what you did there, it really affected me. Or especially with new players when they're learning their first cruise, you know, give them some feedback. If you're not already doing it in the middle of the game, hey, it's like, hey, you know, you did this. I think if you had maybe done it in a different order, it would have been more effective and it would have really bogged down my crew or whatnot. So that way, one, you're being a good opponent, but you're also helping build that meta, learning those crews. And then obviously when you maybe switch to another crew, you know, they can reciprocate and help you learn your crew faster by what from their end is really effective and or maybe not so much.
Yeah. Yeah, that communication can be really valuable, and I think you can improve a lot very quickly if you can play with people who can communicate that effectively at the end of a game.
Yeah, it's just always good to get that extra viewpoint from the opponent's side of it.
Sometimes I find the after-game conversation to be more engaging than the game itself.
Yep.
Yeah. Especially when you have some really firm examples of was this good or was this situation I put you in good or bad for me? Because a lot of what, you know, Theoryfoe and Malifaux podcasting is talking about hypotheticals, right?
Sure.
So,
exactly.
Until you really have a concrete game to look at, it's very difficult to determine anything concretely.
Yeah. I mean, I got an example. Several months ago, I had been putting in some games with Shtook 2, and one of my regular opponents I play on Vassal, Tim from Indianapolis, he'd been giving me some feedback that he didn't think that Anna had been real effective in the games we had played against each other. Now, that could be maybe I'm not putting Anna in good where she's being effective, or is it just maybe in those games she's not effective because I'm not taking her in crews that her auras are going to be as disruptive as other ones. So I had been been switching her out a little bit and putting Monos in because, you know, I heard that Monos can be pretty good too. And and then maybe it's just my play style also, but I thought Monos was, I was getting more bang for my buck with Monos. Other than a game here I played recently where I brought Anna back in because I was playing against May 2 with the whole Ride the Rails. She was pretty disruptive in that. And also,
honestly, I think Anna has a lot going on for her that there's the obvious things with the auras, but like she has a lot of like secret little, I wouldn't say secret, but slightly trickier tech that I feel like if you play her correctly, she's always going to have something she can do that's going to be incredibly powerful. But that's me going on a tangent.
Oh, yeah, I agree. But maybe, like I said, it could be maybe I just wasn't playing her real well. I wasn't putting her, that model, in a position to be as effective as it normally could be. Or maybe it's just not my play style to use her well, whereas with Manos, with my play style, I just get more bang for my buck than I do with Anna. Not, and I'm in no way am I saying is Anna a terrible model, because, I mean, if I did that, I think people in the Malifaux world would storm my house with pitchforks and torches.
No, go ahead. Me. No, go ahead. Say she's bad. Just keep saying it.
No, I'm not going to say
keep
that.
Keep saying it.
I don't want Brian from Texas driving all the way up to my house and
No, just he'll thank you.
As I'm sure he will.
Just keep saying, yeah, he'll come up here and shake your hand. She's bad.
Yeah. but it's just, like, it was probably more me not playing her well, but again, Manos is more my play style. He's a little bit more of an aggressive model than Anna is, where Anna, with her auras, she can be very positional, and that's probably not one of my best areas in the game, is being positional and kind of knowing where my opponent is wanting to go and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why I'm not getting as much mileage out of her as other players.
Well, then here's my challenge to you then. Don't play her like that. Play her like a beater and see how it feels instead. Because if you play her as a beater, she's more likely to be going to the places where her auras will be useful anyways. And okay. Quite frankly, she has one of the best melee attacks out there. So,
other than the fact that she's stat 5.
That's the worst thing about it. But honestly, if you're threatening that, you're ruining their hand. And at that point, her auras are already where they need to be. Otherwise, one of my favorite things to do with her is just setting up a kill with her gun so she can make a zombie and then blow it up. So, like, she is a disruption piece that is surprisingly good at hitting things. So, quite frankly, I mean, she's never going to be just standing around just disrupting. So, I feel like almost playing her like a second string beater is the way to go. And then if whenever you get a situation where you can set up that kill on something with the gun, and turn them into a zombie, suddenly now you're shoving that into people's faces, blowing it up, you're disrupting their hand even further. So I think she presents enough threat with her melee where people will cheat it if you're winning. And sometimes that's fine, And sometimes you'll get a hit through and smack them for moderate 5 and they'll be really sad about it. So
basically just like everything else in Transmortis.
But her weak damage doesn't suck, so...
Yeah, that's true, yeah. But that's, like we had said earlier, that's the kind of feedback that you would want from opponent when you're learning their crew, is like, this Anna, you were kind of hanging her back, and then I should be more aggressive with her, treating her as a second-line beater behind Valedictorian and everything, so...
Yeah, and honestly, that's something that I've actually struggled with myself, because I very much played her too far back early on. And I feel like I still hesitate to put her up there when, generally speaking, she can take it. But I think she should be rolling up there just ahead of Shtuk if you're using Shtuk to move people early on. And then, Val should be the shock, Anna should be the awe, Shtuk should be the grand finale. If that makes sense.
Yes, it makes pretty sense. So what other tips do we have for people who are starting out on their crews?
Yeah, I had one specific example of a model that I rated as garbage tier, but then was quickly proven wrong about. So, Judd and Honey is a model that's in the Angler and Cavalier. So, I didn't bring it because I thought it was bad. And then eventually I ran into Brian, who plays Tall. And he played Judd against me.
Is that the one with an 18-ish Hwacha?
Yes.
I don't understand how you thought that was bad, but I'm really curious to hear how this goes.
So, on paper, it is an 18-inch gun, but it's stat 5, and it's 1-2-2 damage. So that seemed pretty bad. But there's a lot of stuff on his card that you have to understand. The biggest one being Spray and Pray. This model's actions ignore line of sight and friendly fire. If they do, they increase their TN by 3. Who gives a shit? So this means that he can just snipe a support model about anywhere on the board in most deployment zones.
Like, in my opinion, that almost makes him, like, the ultimate scheme runner hunter.
Yeah. He's amazing at that. He can also heal or move people at 18 inches. If he hits his compressed nets, he can drop a shockwave into the middle of their crew, like, turn 1 and stagger them all, which I've had happen once or twice. He is very slow, but Anglers and Cavaliers both have very, very good tools for getting him, you know, whatever, 5 inches up he needs to be able to hit anything on the board.
About to say, he doesn't need to go very far, so his speed doesn't matter all that much.
No.
Just hide him behind a rock.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I mean, it's a 6-stone model. Mm-hmm. So, the other thing that this kind of taught me about the game in general is about, like, Vendetta. Certain models are good at Vendetta, and, you know, Vendetta is a very risky scheme because you'll sometimes just get 0 points, and it will happen. Mm-hmm. But there are some models that can do it semi-reliably, and this would be an example of one, because he can hit a model anywhere on the board. So it really opens up flexibility for you, because anybody can go over, hit the target, and then Judd just taps him for your point. And he's very far away, so there's not a lot your opponent can do about it. So another example is, now I take a lot of Vendetta with Serena, because she has Demise, and she can hole in the world and all kinds of crazy bullshit. So she's likely to live and can even kill the enemy sometimes. So, you know, how I initially envisioned Vendetta was, you bring in the nastiest beater you can and you try to kill their beater. So that, you know, sometimes works, but a lot of times the beater is the hardest thing. So, and some beaters are, you know, can carve up a tank and some cannot. Some are just, you know, if you're never born, then you got that 3-4-6 ignore nothing attack. So some things you can kill, some things you just can't kill. So I lost my train of thought, but I think the point stands.
I wasn't real familiar with that model, so here I have my never born rant. Why does it just get to ignore line of sight and friendly fire for a TN when it's going to be shooting at someone? So more than likely you're going to be cheating high cards to hit, when a Gigant has to discard a card to be able to do that. That is just crap.
I mean,
you're asking too many questions.
I can't disagree with you on that point.
I mean, he's 6 cost. He even has armor.
He has armor,
Why does he have armor? He's going to be sitting in the back. I swear, I said something about Cavalier being bullshit a while ago, but great model, obviously.
I mean, he has armor for the mirror match, so when someone's shooting their Judd and Honey at him, he has armor. Okay, well, but that's a little off topic.
I guess the point there was, if you think a model is bad, I would ask your opponent about it, because you never know, maybe they've seen it or put it on the table and had really good success with it. I'm kind of that guy who will bring every bad model in the game until I've kind of systematically proven to myself that they are not good and unplayable. Right.
And sometimes you just need that different perspective because you're just thinking about it the wrong way.
Totally.
And just like the further point on, like, you know, the aspect of, you know, listening to your opponent. The number of times I've had games where I felt like I was struggling and I wasn't really doing what I needed to do, just to end the game and have my opponent tell me that I was just shutting them down, and they're like, "So I didn't know what to do," and then blah 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 blah. It's like, you know, you don't get that context until after you talk, and then, you know, you learn a lot about your own play and your models and the effect they're having on your opponent. Even when, like, you're like, "Man, I sat there, I swung and I missed a whole bunch," and they're like, "Yeah, but, like, I had to, like, dump cards, and, you know, it put pressure on this because I picked this for this scheme and I thought you were going to kill it," and, you know, things along those lines.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of an example that comes to mind from Magic the Gathering is, if you've ever played against a blue tempo deck, that is an experience that's pretty unique, where when they have the right cards in their hand, you will not get anything onto the board, and then they'll just combo and win all of a sudden, and it's like, this seems like an unbeatable deck, but then you try to play it, and you realize 90% of the time you don't have the right cards, and you have to figure out how to kind of get to that situation from a non-optimal place. So yeah, I would encourage people to try playing the crews that you think are you know, too good or too easy. See for yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
I've definitely learned a lot. Yeah. Just playing solitaire games against myself, you know, it kind of has forced me to read cards more closely and definitely helps learn unpacks and stuff. So there are things you can do.
If people are telling you a model's crap or the internet's not 100% right. Try those models yourself. My example I would use on a model that a lot of people think is subpar is Baltugin in Euripides. Most people think Baltugin are definitely a subpar model. Now, is it a model as I'm learning Euripides more than I'm going to bring all the time? No, but in certain pools, I think, especially like a guard to stash, I mean, he has deadly pursuit, his move 6, ignores severe terrain. You turn 2, maybe get, you know, go with him late, get him where he's near the marker, so he can be 6 inches away. Obviously, assuming you can travel in a straight line because a deadly pursuit is a push, but then he just pushes up there and he can score you a point or deny your opponent a point. And at 5 models, or 5 models, at 5 points, you know, he's cheap. And if he scores you 1 point and then dies, he's done his job. And he's I also like to use him early on in the game is I'll move him up the board and have him use his free action to convert a ski marker that he puts out into a pillar. Because then that way, when my models move up the board, they can end their activation near that and get, you know, heal and gain some shielded. So you're just using the Baltugin. You know, you have to be careful. If you leave him out in the open, he's going to be dead, even though he does have hard to kill. But if you're playing him right, playing him cautious, he's not going to go up there and kill anything. Maybe he finishes something off that has, like, 1 wound or something like that. But it's just something you need to do. Try your play style, and the internet isn't always right. Except for
a lot of those early games are really about learning the crew, but also establishing expectations for your models so that you can go in realistically and go, like, this should be able to accomplish this. And if it does this and dies, that's not a failure. That's it doing what it's supposed to do. And so that's, like, I feel like it's incredibly important, specifically for, like, cheap models, you know, because you don't bring a cheap model in to survive 5 rounds. You bring a cheap model in to do a thing and then die. So coming to terms with that concept and figuring out what that thing is for those cheap models is important. And I think once you establish that for a crew, it really kind of helps open your mind up a bit to them.
Yeah, and kind of another point on that, I didn't like bringing the cheap scheme runners in Neverborn for a long time. Because they do all die, most of them don't have hard to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them won't make it to score that 1 point. But I started learning that those models can be extremely powerful when you apply pressure to the other side of the board very heavily. So if you want to score on the right side of the board, make your opponent look at the left side of the board. And now all of a sudden, your scheme runners are never dying because your opponent has a giant fire to deal with. So yeah, I think trying to come at things from different angles also can be pretty useful.
Yeah, absolutely. Being able to put pressure on your opponent, whether it's with the cheap models or, you know, throwing Castle Fervent right in the middle of their crew halfway through turn one, can be definitely a way to allow your other models to do things that might be tougher, but if you're putting the pressure on with models that maybe you're not counting on to score points, they're just the disruptor while your other models are scoring, is definitely a way of going about it. And that's, again, when you're practicing a new crew, finding out that play style for that crew and trying different things. Well, like, I don't know if this is going to work, but, you know, Leroy Jenkins, your master right in the middle of their crew.
Yeah. It's a great way to find out how fast they die.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have anything else, Zach?
I do not.
Okay, cool. Well, yeah, I guess the final thing I'd say is everybody go out there and try new keywords. This is almost like a PSA, I guess, because I feel like I've kind of been a Neverborn stan, And everyone, you know, everyone in the community looks to me as the leader of the Neverborn. The one who lead us to the top of the pack, you know, in the tournament scene. But,
are you admitting defeat?
Trying out another faction was super fun. And, I think, you know, it's great to stick to one faction, and I think if you want to win, you definitely should stick to a couple different crews, but I think branching out and trying new things also will make you better at those other crews, too. So,
if anything, it'll teach you crews that other people will be playing, and the more familiar you are with more models, the better you're going to do, ultimately, because meta knowledge is a big deal here.
Yeah, definitely. And even when you're playing a different crew, maybe even in a different faction, it can open your eyes to things like, oh, I'm doing this, let's say, in your example, with the Anglers. I have something similar I can do with Neverborn that I never thought of in whatever crew. And like, well, maybe I could take what I'm learning from the Anglers or whatever crew that may be and apply it to maybe something in Neverborn and kind of give a fresh perspective on something. And you know, and in general also to help freshen up the excitement for the game. You know, at the end of 2E, I was getting kind of burned out on my Neverborn, and that's when I started playing some Rezzers. So kind of freshens your excitement for the game, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, I think that's a good end for it. So thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.